What we've tried to do in this series is to get you to think specifically about three particular points, one of which is that there is a difference in the different, there are three different theories of evolution. We need to recognize that. One of them, as far as I can tell, as I told you on the night of the, when I dealt with genetics, does not conflict with the Bible in any way, and that's basically Darwin's concept of natural selection. The general theory of evolution and, of course, the chemical concept of life coming from non-life are pretty much just theories and pretty much based on faith if you believe them. The other thing that I mentioned is this number two point, and that is that there's a great difference between evidence, the interpretation of that evidence. If you are a general evolutionist, you are going to accept the bottom part of this chart. You're going to look for an original source of life that came after the Big Bang and life coming from non-life, and from that original life, you would have single-cell things that became multicellular, and then multicellular things would become fish, then amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. And how you explain the tips and the nodes of all of those branches is on the basis of the general theory of evolution, the chemical theory of evolution, and a very natural creation. You just pretty much decide to leave God out of that picture. I believe it's possible, accepting the special theory of evolution, natural selection within limits, change within limits that I talked about the other night, to accept God's statement about the supernatural creation, which occurred over a six-day period of 24-hour days, that you can accept the miracles of the Bible, and you'll find that your interpretation of the evidence may be different, but it will not violate any of the facts of science. We just simply explain the tips and the nodes of the branches in a different way. And I've given you the quote on special evolution before, and we've looked at lots of things like this slide here, at all of the different varieties of humans, and humans clearly appear to be one of the biblical kinds. God created us unique in His own image. We find lots of different species of plants and animals, but the kind, the Genesis kind, very obviously can be at different levels of our classification. The more general theory of evolution, that everything came from that non-living source, I said pretty much gives us this little tree of life. And that's kind of a stylistic thing that is based on some of the evidence that we find within the fossil record. And that's part of what I'm going to talk about. One of my favorite cartoons is one that I think actually expresses for most of us the difference between the animal and plant world and that of humans, which is this. Pretty much if you look at the rest of life, it's eat, survive, reproduce. That's the whole purpose of life. But when you get to us, we're the only ones who are going to sit back and say, well, what's it all about? And that shows that we are very, very unique, that reflective thinking. Tonight I want to deal with paleontology, and I had to write my own statement of evidence. I tried my very best to find statements out of my books. Instead of using creationist literature, I tried to take it out of my textbooks. But when it came down to the evidence in paleontology, I ended up having to state it for myself. I never could unweave the interpretation from the evidence. The truth is, and the facts are, that some rocks, not all rocks, but some rocks have fossils in them. And what we also know is that most fossils are found in ocean or marine sediments. All right, but we do find them in terrestrial deposits in lakes and streams, pretty much all waterborne in their origin. The promise of paleontology is that the history of life ceases to be hypothesis. It ceases to be some kind of guess, and it becomes direct knowledge when fossils are available, and that is what most geologists believe. You can find some pretty amazing geological formations in the mountains throughout the world. Even if you go out to the Grand Canyon, I've had a chance to see that from the air. I've never stood on any of the rims of the Grand Canyon to look at it. They tell me it's magnificent. That theoretically theoretically covers about 1.5 million years of geologic evolution on the planet, and it has layer after layer of rock, many of them containing very different kinds of fossils. So I want to talk about this chart. I want to talk about how it's put together. And this is a very old chart that John Clark gave me out of one of my textbooks. And the reason that I like it is because they were honest enough to leave dotted lines where we do not have fossils. I want you to think about that a second, but many of the charts that we see have very solid lines as though there's a very clear connection. But in this chart, they show very clearly the dotted lines, the fossils we do not have in between all of the major groups of organisms. I think this is a very honest way to do it. I need to talk about a principle called superposition. Just think about this a minute. The Smoky Mountains are a fairly old range of mountains. We tend to think of them as mountains. If you were living in the western part of the United States, they would be hills. The coastal hills of California are as tall as the Smoky Mountains. And what happens is that the mountains begin to erode down. Organisms die. They're washed down in a stream. They're washed out, say, into rivers that take them to the Gulf of Mexico, and they're deposited in sediments. And that just continues and continues and continues. And so if I ask you, where would you expect to find the oldest fossils, you would expect to find them on the bottom of that pile, right? At the, you know, the oldest ones, the ones that died first, would be down at the bottom. This is called the law of superposition. It's not unlike when you go back trying to find an article in the newspaper and you go to that place, there's a place in your house where you throw those papers every day and they pile up and they pile up. And you say, well, I think that was about a month ago, and you start digging way down in the pile, right? As opposed to looking for the paper that came from yesterday, which should be up on the top. Well, that's the idea of the law of superposition. The implication of it is that if you go out and look at the fossil record, that you will see a nice, clear series of fossils that lead from single cell to multicellular to fish, amphibian, reptile, bird, and mammal almost any place that you dig on the face of the earth. And I've actually heard general evolutionists say that any time somebody drills for oil, they go down right through this and they just show the evidence and prove general evolution all over again. I was actually surprised the first time I found this, but in the geology textbook by Castor and Engen, I think it is, von Engen, they pointed out that the geologic time column that you see in all of the textbooks doesn't actually exist any place on the face of the earth. What you see in the textbooks is some kind of composite where people have brought these layers together and they put a composite sequence together to show all of the things that we have. And you will find that there are other people who have pointed this out, but it would take a pile of rock about 100 miles thick to be able to include all of the fossil formations that we have identified around the world. So there really isn't any place on the face of the earth where you can do this. On top of that, there's not any place on the face of the earth where you won't find layers out of sequence on top of, in between, or underneath some other layer where they're not supposed to be. These are photographs from the U.S. Geological Survey, and then on the next one there'll be some from the Canadian Geological Survey. And if the oldest ones are supposed to be at the bottom of this listing, right, you can see that in many places the very oldest rocks are actually sitting on top of what they consider to be very modern rocks. The general evolutionist explanation of that is that these lower rocks were shoved up over the younger, and then the intermediate layers were eroded away. And the things that we're talking about shoving around are sometimes miles thick, 650 miles long, and 5 miles wide. That's a pretty big chunk of earth to be moving around. Well, they're completely out of sequence in so many places that I don't think that we can ignore that. So rocks that are the oldest may end up on the top. And those that are the youngest may end up on the bottom, which is just exactly opposite from that law of superposition. So, what's the point of this? Earth history is not recorded in a single outcrop. This is out of my Outlines of Historical Geology book by Dunbar. Earth history is not recorded in a single outcrop or on one continent. The records for many regions must be pieced together. Now, this is the second time that we've come on that phrasing. In their proper order until we have the composite sequence of events. So, my question is, how do you piece them together? How do you decide what rock is supposed to be on top of or below any other rock? All right. So again, I come back to this idea of, I forget sometimes where I am on the left column here. When I was studying with John Clark and then later with Steve Wolfgang, who Steve and Betty have been a tremendous influence for Darlene and I, very good friends, and he has helped me so much to kind of keep the faith as I've gone through some of the things I've encountered. We put together this idea, and this really comes from John Clark. The first thing that he said about the geologic timescale is that you have to accept evolution as a fact. Now, obviously in this case, we didn't have general and special in there, but I don't want to change this chart because it's the original one. But we're meaning general evolution, are we not? Can you see that? And you'll see it very clearly in a minute. To the geologist, evolution is a fact, not a theory, although not all the causes of evolution are known. That came out of my geology college outline series. Using fossils. Without fossils, the details of geologic history could never have been pieced together. That's from Zumberg's geology textbook. And then applying the doctrine of uniformitarianism. And the idea of uniformitarianism is that if you want to see a mountain being built today, if you can see a mountain being built today, then every mountain that has ever existed has been built that way. If you want to see it eroded, if you can watch it being eroded down, that's the way it's happened for all mountains. Whatever geologic process you look at is very slow. It's over a very long period of time. All right? It's very uniform, and that's how we need to interpret geology. I'll come back to that a little bit later. I don't need to read the whole quote on that. But I still want to go back to the fact that this geologic time column that we see in all the textbooks really doesn't exist anyplace on the face of the earth. In fact, if you go back, and this may be hard for you to read because I can't read it, if you go back to this idea of the cryptozoic eon, it is at the bottom of this chart. Do you see the word cryptozoic? What do you think the word cryptozoic means? You can figure this out. Cryptic is what? Hidden. Zoe or zoo is the root word for organisms or zoology. It's the same root we use for zoology. So hidden life. We don't call it the Cryptozoic anymore. We call it the Pre-Cambrian. And one of the interesting things about the geologic column is that in the Pre-Cambrian, even though we have 5/6 of all of the rock on the face of the earth, there are no fossils. Now, it doesn't mean that the rock couldn't have fossils. It's limestones and sandstones could very easily have had fossils. But there are no fossils in 5/6 of the Earth's rocks. In other words, if you really wanted to put this column for the Earth's rocks to scale, you would have to add 5 more of these charts down below this before you ever get to life in the geologic column. And that would go way down underneath this floor, about 50 feet. And so what he says is this vast eon includes about 5/6 of geologic time, and then it gives what he considers to be the dates in and so on. But lacking fossils suitable for correlation, we can't divide it into units of more than local application. What did you just learn from that? If a rock doesn't have a fossil in it, you have no idea whether it's older or younger. whether or where it is supposed to be in this column. And the reason that I say that is that I was pointing out that this column, thought I was going to get by without a mistake tonight. Well, that was a mistake. Geologic time column does not exist, and the idea is if you're going to piece this together, the question is, what are you using to piece it together? And the answer is, you're using your concept of general evolutionary theory to piece the organisms together in their proper order. And that is still true. And this is not coming from a creationist. This is coming from geologists in their textbooks. Now, we can test things in local application over shorter periods of time. There are these tree ring applications. We just hired a very excellent botanist into our faculty who does tree ring chronology. I'm very excited that Neil is on our faculty. You can look at varves and spelothemes and corals and ice cores. Lots of things that we can do that will help you to determine time over a very small and very isolated local area. All right, and that's what all of these things actually represent. We see these people doing it. They can go, for instance, to the North Pole. They can take a core out of the ice cap at the North Pole, and we have the technology now to measure time for, say, 10,000 years and actually take off little tiny increments of snow that have fallen over 10,000 years and be able to know the difference in the atmospheric gases that are present every year for 10,000 years. I think that's pretty amazing, don't you? And that's what these guys are doing. Well, you know, Darwin had two problems with the geologic column. Number one, he was very bothered by the fact that there were no fossils in 5/6 of the Earth's rocks. It just bothered him. There were no Precambrian fossils. The other thing that really bothered him, probably more than anything else, was that where he should have had transitional fossils in the geologic column, they simply didn't exist. All the intermediate fossils seem to be missing. And there have been all sorts of explanations that people have come up with. If you've ever heard the concept of punctuated equilibrium, that's pretty much an attempt by people to explain how general evolution could have occurred really fast and not left any fossils before you start leaving fossils again. You know, sometimes in our faith, we're not sure how to explain something and we invoke a miracle. If you're a geneticist, you're going to invoke a mutation, and if you're a geologist, you're going to invoke a punctuated equilibrium to fill the gap. These are the These are the oldest fossils that we know in the world. They are microscopic fossils, and I'm willing to accept them as microscopic fossils. I'm not going to challenge that. I always try to allow the strongest argument. And the idea is that these are fossils that lived in the Precambrian, and they are the oldest, some people say back to 1.6 billion. And what these fossils did is they extended it back another 3,000 million years, which is 3 billion. Well, the Earth is only thought to be 5 billion years old, but the oldest rocks are only 3.5 billion. The explanation for that is that all of those earlier rocks were eroded away or destroyed in some way. And so, you'll never get a date that's over 3.5 billion. Let's just say that these fossils existed. The idea is that they came into existence as single cells in this very primitive environment that was on the Earth's surface, where there was no oxygen, present. A primitive gaseous atmosphere that simply did not contain oxygen. It is the famous experiments of Urey and Stanley Miller and so on, where they had the flask and they shot the spark through it with the methane in the water and so on. But there was no oxygen in there. Does anybody know why oxygen could not be present in order for life to come from non-life? Well, That is a good point. There would be no plants, and that's why you would have no oxygen. But what would happen if you did have oxygen and you went by their theory to try to create life from non-life? Paradoxically, oxygen is the most caustic material that you know, and yet it keeps you alive. But you know what it does to an old wet anchor chain, don't you? It'll destroy it. It'll oxidize it. Oxygen is what oxidizes things. And I just think it's kind of amazing that what we take into our lungs to stay alive is one of the most caustic elements that we find on the face of the earth in terms of a molecule. If you had oxygen present at the beginning, anytime something new came into existence, the oxygen would have immediately destroyed it. So they have always had to postulate that there was no oxygen present at the beginning in these older rocks. Well, recently in the Discover magazine, buried, I might add, almost deeper than you can imagine. It's on page 11. You remember the Discover magazine that had the actual size of the earth as a red ball? In that particular issue, if you go to page 11 and you look over in the bottom right-hand corner, you will find cleverly disguised an article that says that oxygen had to be present in that early atmosphere, which would pretty much throw out that other concept completely. And what happened is they were looking down there and they found some things that were rusted, and they should not have been rusted. They're called pisoliths. And they should not be rusted. The only way they could be rusted is if oxygen was present. And yet they are also in the same rocks that are 3 to 3.5 billion years old. Now, if you read this article, you'll see that they don't put much credence in it, but I was kind of impressed that they actually published it in Discover. But they sort of poo-poo it as best they can. But it still goes back to this idea that Darwin had a couple of problems there. This absence of life in the Precambrian and the absence of intermediate forms. And yet when we see it drawn, it always has solid lines. You know, a very nice, clean tree, solid lines leading from one group to the other. Well, the truth is, everybody has known for a long time that there are these big gaps. And one of the men who worked on that was Niles Eldridge. And he was interviewed in that, I think it was in the Luther Sunderland's Darwin's Enigma, Fossils and Other Problems. And this is what he says. I admit that an awful lot of fantasy. Now, this is a general evolutionist, okay? A general evolutionist, not a creationist. I admit that an awful lot of that fantasy has gotten into the textbooks as though it were true. For instance, the most famous exhibit is still on, the famous example is still on exhibit downstairs in the American Museum of Natural History. And it's the one on horse evolution that we always see in the textbooks. That was prepared perhaps 50 years ago and has been presented as literal truth in textbook after textbook. Now, I think that's lamentable because, particularly because the people who propose these kinds of stories themselves may be aware of the speculative nature of some of the stuff, but by the time it filters down to the textbooks, we've got science as truth and we've got a problem. So what's he saying to you? What he's saying to you is what I have said to you over and over again. Our textbooks are not filled with evidence. They are filled with evidence and one particular interpretation. And we are not allowed to present another interpretation for fear of being prosecuted to the full extent of the law because they say we're teaching our religion. But it isn't the evidence that we disagree with. It is the interpretation of that evidence. The other one who got into this was Stephen Jay Gould, and he just recently died, and he was probably one of the best essay writers in science today for popularizing science. He was a general evolutionist, he was a secular humanist, and he was an atheist. He won many awards from the secular humanist and the atheist for his beliefs. And he's an anti-creationist, and he has now died, and I'm sorry for that. I had always hoped that I might get a chance to meet him. But here's the quote that he made about these fossils in the fossil record. The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and the nodes of their branches. The rest is inference. I have interference. How many times have I used this that way? I cannot believe I just noticed that. Actually, I should have just told you I put it in there to see if you caught it. Well, anyway, the rest is inference, however reasonable, and it's not evidence from the fossils. And I think that's a very honest statement. Now, both Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould got together to create this concept that we call punctuated equilibrium to explain the transitions. But, you know, when you start saying, well, it's just that the process got speeded up and it didn't leave any fossils, that begins to sound like you're reaching, grabbing for straws at that point. And I've always felt that way. So here's this chart, you know, the way you see it normally drawn. David Boltenheiser did a book on evolution and creation where he began to remove pieces of this chart, which does not seem to be doing it automatically at the moment. And he actually gave in that book, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the book right now, Evolution and Christian Faith, I believe it is. He went through, that's interesting, lost some of those. He went through and he gave 81 quotes from the experts on every one of the organisms that is on this chart. It changed the size of it too. That really is interesting. And his whole purpose in this was to show that the experts in the area stated in their publications that they had no idea how their group of organisms could have evolved through general evolution from what was supposed to have come before it. And so if you take out the lines that are supposedly solid lines and you listen to what they were saying, you pretty much end up with this, which is evidence, correct? And that's the interpretation. You know, and that's the evidence, and that's the interpretation. And I have no problem with that. I'm going to say it again. If somebody wants to do that, that's fine. I just think you need to tell students that that's what you're doing. You know, show them the evidence without the interpretation, and then show them the best interpretations that you can. Well, they always say, oh, but we do have transitional fossils, and they always bring up Archaeopteryx. I won't make you try to spell that, and it is not on the quiz at the end of the discussion. But they will say, what about Archaeopteryx? And you say, who is Archaeopteryx? Well, this is Archaeopteryx. This is the one and only fossil of Archaeopteryx. It is in the British Museum, and it's the only one that shows feathers on it. And it appears to be a feathered reptile. And I absolutely agree. It shows both bird and reptile characteristics. All right? Everybody thinks of this as being so large, but it's about the size of a pigeon, and it's squashed flat. Okay? But from that, when my books come, this is what I get. You know, this is what they're drawing it from. And then when it comes into my textbooks to show it to my students as an overhead, it comes in full color, you know, with all the feathers and so on. And obviously you've just made a big shift from evidence to interpretation. But I do want to say that there's no doubt in my mind that this has reptilian characteristics. The things that you would look for in the left side over here is the multiple holes in the head. We call them foramina, holes in the head. Sorry. We call them holes in the head. A pigeon has one hole for the eye socket, but reptiles have several holes that are in the skull. Birds, like pigeons, have a number of other characteristics. You'll notice, though, that there are claws on the ends of the wings of this particular thing we call Archaeopteryx. And until they found this one fossil that looked like it had feathers imprinted, they had classed this as a reptile. Okay? Well, what about it? You know, we have five now, but there's only one that shows the feathers. The British Museum won't show it to anybody. Everybody wants to look at the other piece of rock for the other side of it, but they won't show it to anybody. And so there are people who approach this from the standpoint that this is a hoax. Well, now I'm willing to grant this and grant their strongest argument that this is a flying reptile that had feathers, okay? I'm willing to do that. But I'm going to show you that that's not enough to support general evolutionary theory, and you'll see why very quickly. So they've gone through and they've very nicely done all of this. And again, I just keep getting these. I collect overheads for all of these books, and I just keep getting these beautiful multicolor pictures of Archaeopteryx, okay? Reptiles are rather interesting. They have scales for protection, and they are terrestrial and basically have lots and lots of muscles. And birds fly, and they're not nearly as heavy. And there's a lot of differences between them that I could go into in terms of modern birds and Archaeopteryx and so on, but particularly just in modern birds. Believe it or not, their circulatory system is completely different from a reptile circulatory system, and significantly different. Their lungs and their major muscles are, and I'll come back to this in a minute, their lungs are completely different. When a bird is breathing out, it gets oxygen to its body. We can't do that. Reptiles can't do that. When it breathes in, it gets oxygen, and when it breathes out, it gets oxygen. So that's a very, very different set of lungs, isn't it? Okay. It has hollowed out bones. All right, so reptiles have solid bones like you and I do, but we have learned from the hollowed out bones of an eagle how to do struts and make wings on these big old jet airliners. Come carry me away. We have learned from this how to make reinforce the wings of these planes and make them twice as strong and twice as light, just by looking at bird wing. And there's a lot of differences that I could look into. This is just it. But let's just look at this hummingbird, which is rather interesting, and let's just consider one particular characteristic. Let's look at the muscles that pull the wings up and pull the wings down. That would be a pretty important set of muscles for a bird, right? If you can't do that, you're probably not going to fly. All right? Well, it turns out, and this, I think I will go back for just a second to one that I had a minute ago. If you will look on the right-hand side of this, you will find out that all of the muscles for flight are on the front side of the bird. You wonder why you like chicken breasts and turkey breasts, and you don't eat a lot of chicken backs? It's because there's no meat on the back of a chicken. Okay? I don't know what people are eating when they do that, but pretty much all the muscles are on the front. Now, this is a rather unusual thing because reptiles are like us. If I wanted to change my body, or let's say I'm a bird, and I wanted to fly, in order to raise my arms, I'm doing that with my back muscles, right? And in order to pull down, I'm doing that with the muscles on the front side of my body. And that's the way a reptile is too. If they want to lift their arms, they've got back muscles, and if they want to pull them down, they've got chest muscles. But birds are not that way. Birds have all of their muscles for raising their wings and bringing their wings down, and they're all on the front side, right along the keel and the wishbone. Okay? Now, you had to get to this from a reptile. Do you grasp my point here? We're going to talk about general evolution, and we're going to say how easy would it be just on this particular thing to get to a bird from a reptile. You're going to have to move all of the muscles from the back, put them on the front, and then put in a little pulley system that goes up and over the shoulder blade so that when some of the muscles on the front contract, the wings go up, and when the other muscles contract, the wings come down. That's how birds fly, and that's how they're made, and no reptile is made that way. So there's a real big gap here. It's a humongous gap in the fossil record. It's not enough to say that Archaeopteryx is a flying reptile. You have to explain how it could fly using muscles like we have and not muscles like a bird has. All right? And it does. It does fly. If this is right, it'll work on its own. Okay? The interior muscles go over a little... Okay? He's gliding. The interior muscles go over in kind of a hook pulley system, and they pull those wings up, and then the other set of muscles pulls the wing down. And as you probably know, and I don't have to tell you, we go back to something that we've pointed out before. If you want to believe that a bird came from a reptile, you're going to have a whole lot of faith. Now, I'm going to add a couple of things to this that I didn't talk about. You've seen the muscles. I don't know how you take the muscles off the back of a reptile, put them on its chest, and put that hook and pulley system in. And until somebody can show me that, I'm not going to take seriously the idea that birds came from reptiles. That is a gap that is phenomenal. It's huge, okay? But let's think about this a second. What are the scales for on a reptile? Protection, right? Hard scales for protection and to keep it from desiccating because it's a terrestrial organism. What do you have to do to the scales to get to feathers? Has anybody ever shown any evidence or any research that gets us from a scale to a feather? No, they haven't. Well, let's say that they did. Let's just grant them that argument. Let's say that one day, you know, mama reptile finds in her nest a little baby reptile where all of the scales have turned to feathers. Will it be able to fly? No. A few other things we've got to change. Obviously, we have to change those muscles. Okay. What do you think is going to happen with your knowledge of animal behavior to something that shows up in the nest that different? The mother's going to throw it out and the siblings are going to kill it. And we all know that that happens. But let's just say that the mother doesn't throw it out. It keeps feeding it, and the siblings do not kill it. And let's just say that all of those feathery things actually are more complex at this point, and they actually are like feathers, all right? Well, until the feathers can have muscles that cause every single feather on a bird has to have a set of muscles to control it. Until you develop those muscles, that bird's not going to be able to fly. So the most likely thing is that some predator's going to pick it off and we're never going to know that it ever existed. All right? But let's say that the mother didn't throw it out, the siblings didn't kill it, and predators didn't kill it, and it keeps on developing. All right? And no general evolutionist is going to say that it went from a reptile to a bird in one generation. Nobody's ever going to do that. It's got to be gradual, right, over time? So let's just say that, and then let's just say that somehow it finds a way to hollow its bones out, and it takes the muscles off its back, and they get put on the front, and you get the pulley system, and it's actually ready to fly, and every single feather has muscles that allow it to be plane so that it can actually glide and turn and do all the things it needs to do when it flies. There's still one major problem with this particular thing flying. This might be a little harder for you to see, but it simply isn't going to know it can fly. You're going to have to rewire its nervous system, its ability, how it learned. What did it pattern it on? Every bird I know has some stuff that is genetic, you know, and maybe a little bit of learning, but most of it is just purely hardwired into the organism. It's a genetic hardwiring. And this thing is going to be genetically hardwired to be a reptile, so as far as I can tell, you're going to have a bird running around acting like a reptile. Now, you know, it's really easy to make up those stories and say, this is our transitional fossil, but I just gave you about 20 different things that are transitions that we would have to be able to show before you could ever call it a transition. It is not a transitional fossil, but it is for people where their faith is the substance of the things they hope for, and it's their evidence of things they have not seen. Don't tell me general evolutionists do not have a very, very strong faith, sometimes stronger than we have in our own stated beliefs. There was a letter written by Luther Sunderland to Colin Patterson. Colin Patterson spent 25 years studying vertebrate paleontology. He studied all the vertebrates and everything, and he put together his life's work. All right, but there were apparently some things missing, and Luther wrote back to him, and you can't read that, and this may not be much better, but I can read this. Dear Mr. Sunderland, thanks for your letter of March 5th and your kind words about the museum. This is the British Museum and my book. I held off answering you for a couple of weeks in case the artwork that you mention in your letter should turn up, but it hasn't. I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. So obviously Luther was asking him the obvious question. How do you explain the transitions in vertebrate evolution? If I knew of any. Now this is not some geneticist and this is not some creationist. This is a person who has dedicated his entire professional career to vertebrate paleontology. And what is his statement? If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. He's saying there are no transitions. You suggest that an artist should be asked to visualize such transformations, but where would he get the information from? I could not honestly provide it, and if I were to leave it to artistic license, would that not mislead the reader? Like the Archaeopteryx pictures in full color? Kinda. I wrote the text of my book 4 years ago. If I were to write it now, I think the book would be rather different. Gradualism, which is one of the British ways of referring to Darwin's concept of general evolution. Gradualism is a concept I believe in, not just because of Darwin's authority. I find it so interesting to hear him use that word authority with Darwin. We have a Darwin Day, you know, on February 12th. You know, did you know that? You didn't celebrate it? Shame on you. Not just because of Darwin's authority, but because new understanding of genetics seems to demand it. That's supposed to be my. Now, why would a person who has studied vertebrate paleontology for his entire career and wrote a definitive textbook on it say, you know, Darwin's authority and genetics seems to demand it? Why wouldn't he say the fossil record demands this because this is the real stuff? This is the stuff that proves it, proof positive, right? And he doesn't do it. So he goes on and he says, yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. As a paleontologist myself, I'm much occupied with the philosophic problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. You say I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type organism was derived. In other words, the transitional fossils. I'll lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. The reason is that statements about ancestry and descent, which is general evolution, okay, that statements about general evolution are not applicable in the fossil record. Isn't that an amazing statement being made by a vertebrate paleontologist? Because I gave you a quote earlier that said, it stops being guesswork and it becomes direct knowledge when you have the fossils. But this vertebrate paleontologist is saying it ain't that way at all. The reason is that statements about ancestry and descent aren't applicable in the fossil record. Is Archaeopteryx the ancestor of all birds? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. Get this. There is no way of answering the question. It is easy enough to make up stories of how one form gave rise to another and find reasons why the stages should be favored by natural selection. But such stories are not a part of science, for there is no way of putting them to a test. This is nothing but my evidence and interpretation thing all over again. And the point is, when you can't see it, when you can't work with it, when you cannot test it, when you cannot experiment, it is not a part of science. All right, it is not a part of science the way we want it to be, that is for sure. But such stories are not a part of science, for there's no way of putting them to the test. So he just says, I don't have the intellectual justification for doing it. Now, Colin Patterson went around to all sorts of evolutionary symposia, and he started challenging biologists and paleontologists with his ideas that we need to be careful saying that there are transitional fossils, because we don't have a way in the world to prove that. They're just stories. They're just ideas. They're somebody's faith, is essentially what he was saying. Well, he really caught it. He was going against the accepted view, and when you go against the accepted view, you're going to get slapped down. And he did. He got slapped down really hard. He was interviewed for Harper's Magazine by Tom Bethel. And Bethel, this is what Bethel writes about Colin Patterson. He ordered something from the menu and he said, one has to live with one's colleagues. They hold the theory very dear. I found out that what you say will be taken in political rather than rational terms. Patterson told me that he regarded the theory of evolution, meaning general evolution, as often unnecessary in biology. In fact, he said they could do perfectly well without it. Nevertheless, it was presented in textbooks as though it were the unified field theory of biology, holding the whole subject together and binding the profession to it. Once something has that status, he says, it becomes like religion. Amen and amen. So, Archaeopteryx, no, that's not the evidence. That's not the evidence. That's the evidence. That's the interpretation. That is the evidence. That is the interpretation. And if you want to believe that that happened, it's going to be faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, I really believe that every one of us has an obligation to test our faith. You know, even though we believe it and we believed it for a long time, we do not need to fear. How is it we always say it to congregations? Truth does not fear investigation. And I'm going to make a critical point here before I move on. And that is that sometimes I think that we try to protect our children from the world to such an extent that we put them like in a little monastery. And we don't teach them what's being taught in the universities. We don't teach them how to answer the things that are being taught in the university. You know, when your kids go to school, they don't lose their faith because they went to the university. More likely, they lose their faith because you didn't know how to prepare them for what they were going to come up with at the university. And that falls back on preachers and congregations and elders to do the job of explaining to them what they're going to run into. So that when they go into the philosophy class and the professor says, if you believe in an all-powerful God, is he powerful enough to create a rock that he cannot lift? It doesn't just blow their day. You give them some way of dealing with the kinds of things, because there's a lot of mocking of the biblical principles when you get into the university setting. Lots of good religious people there, but there's also a lot of mocking that goes on. Okay? I think we need to examine our faith. I think we need to make our children aware of it. You know, I'm not against homeschooling. I work with homeschoolers all the time. You know, my kids, Darlene and I, let our kids go to public school. You know, I just think there's lots of different ways to do it. But we need to allow people to see the other ideas to some extent and then, you know, have the courage to let them listen to them and help them figure out why they are wrong, what the answer is to that. And that takes a lot of effort, to be honest with you. Here's the point that I want to make. The promise of paleontology is that the history of life ceases to be a hypothesis or a guesswork and becomes direct knowledge when the fossils are available. And the truth is that paleontology has not delivered on that promise. And Colin Patterson is a perfect example of somebody to go to. Now, I need to talk about the age of the Earth real quick. I had to write my own evidence on this too. The Earth is older than man's recorded history. That was about as close as I could come to an honest statement of the evidence. General evolution needs lots of time. If you want to know why the big debate over the age of the Earth, in order to get from single cell up to man in general evolution, you need a ton of time. So if oak trees and humans share a common ancestor, that ancestor had to live a long time ago, and time would be the hero of the plot. All right, and George Wald said in Scientific American, the time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years, and what we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Once you have that much time, what you see as impossible becomes possible, and the possible becomes probable, and that which is probable virtually certain. One only has to wait. Time performs the miracles. So we set about at one point to try to figure out how to estimate the age of the earth. And a lot of people decided that they didn't like the biblical chronology of Usher, which actually is Usher's idea, not the Bible's. Okay? That's one of the mistakes that's been made. And we set out to do it, and we did it through the biblical chronology, start from the bottom of the chart and go up. We looked at the expansion of the universe, sedimentation rates in the ocean, ocean salinity, tidal friction. And then we got to the so-called final word, which was the radioactive dating methods. Okay? Now, I think most of you know enough about Bishop Usher that we can skip over what he and Lightfoot did on the biblical genealogies. Begat does not necessarily mean a father-son relationship. It never has. Okay? And to just add the generations up, the Bible clearly skips generations in different places. So let's talk a little bit about radioactive decay. If I start out with radioactive uranium-238, eventually that thing is going to be so unstable that various particles like alpha and gamma rays are just going to shoot out of it, all right, until it ends up as a stable isotope of lead. It goes from uranium to lead. Thorium does the same thing, from thorium to lead. It will not remain stable. And it will do it in a very characteristic way. Uranium to lead and thorium to lead on the left side over here are the hour hands of the geologic clock. Potassium to argon measures the minute hand. Carbon-14 is kind of like measuring seconds within geologic time. It all happens because as radioactive materials decay in a substance, they decay with a half-life. Now, I don't know how to explain this any better than this. I'm going to go to something like carbon-14. You and I, as long as we live, are taking in some radioactive carbon with our regular carbon. And when we die, we have a certain amount of radioactive carbon in our bodies, which will begin to decay. And in 5,700 and some years, one half of it will be gone. And then in another 5,700 and some years, another half of it will be gone, which really is one-eighth of what you started with. You see what I mean? And so on and so on. So you end up with a curve like this, and you can demonstrate this curve with radioactive decay. I've done it in the classroom with one of my chemistry and physicist friends, where we actually took some radioactive material and we counted the number of decays and so on with a counter until we got this nice reverse logistic curve. Well, what I want you to understand is that theoretically it never all disappears, right? It's like that old riddle. If you take a trip, if Darlene and I go from Louisville to Frankfurt and we take half the distance every day, when will we get there? Well, theoretically, we would never get there, right? We'd always have half the distance to go. So there are some assumptions in all of the dating methods, and I'm not going to make a big difference between these things. But if you can think of this radioactive material like a child sparkler on the 4th of July, you have some stuff that was there to begin with, the initial conditions. And then all of this stuff starts sparkling off and shooting off. And then when all of that is done, you end up with something that's stable that just has ash on it, right? It stops after a while. Well, that's the best I can do to give an illustration of what happens in radioactive decay. You have to know something about how much was there when I began, how much was there when I got done, and you must know the rate of decay. And everybody has said for years and years and years that the rate of decay of radioactive materials cannot be changed by anything. Well, Robert Gentry started studying that, and when I wrote something for the president of the University of Alabama on this, John and I wrote that old green book that some of you still have someplace that I do not have a copy of, Paul, that original thing that John and I wrote. The basic assumption is that you cannot change the rate of decay. Some of you who are older will remember the old John Cameron Swayze Timex commercials. He put those Timex watches on everything in the world you could imagine, and it would take a licking, and it would keep on ticking, right? Well, that's the idea of radioactive decay, that you can take something that has radioactive materials in it, and you can put it any place, all right, and it will just take a licking and keep on ticking, and you can't speed it up and you can't slow it down. Now, people have suggested over time, and that's in this paragraph, that that can happen. Well, Gentry decided to start studying something called pleochroic halos with radioactive materials. And this is not a very difficult concept. Pleochroic is just the Greek way of saying Joseph's coat of many colors. Okay? It's just a many-colored halo, all right, that forms under certain light conditions. And you will find it around anything that is radioactive in crystalline rock. And what's interesting about pleochroic halos is they are like the fingerprint for that particular radioactive material. It makes a specific set of colors, and you know by the radius and the colors you're dealing with uranium or thorium or polonium or what have you. He started studying these to see if the rate of decay had actually remained stable. All right? And his conclusion was that the rate of radioactive decay has probably changed considerably during geologic time. It wasn't as stable as everybody thought it was. Now, he has been attacked by everybody, maybe justifiably, but he has been attacked by everybody because he went against the going doctrine. All right? Well, let's stop and think about this for a second. Let's think about some short-lived radioactive isotopes. The half-life of polonium-214 is 164 microseconds. That's less than a billionth of a blink of an eye. That's really what that is. That's pretty fast, isn't it? That's almost as fast as a guest speaker to the table when they're doing a meeting. According to one theory of the planet's origin, the Earth cooled down from a hot, gaseous mass, and then gradually it solidified over a period of hundreds of millions of years. If it were so, polonium halos could not possibly have formed because all of the polonium would have decayed soon after it was synthesized and would have been gone before you ever got these rocks. You'd never get a halo. You'd never have a solid rock because all that stuff would be gone. So you'd never find fingerprints for polonium-214. Unless the creation of radioactivity and the rocks were simultaneous, there would be no picture, no variant pleochroic halos. Further, by virtue of their very short half-life, the radioactivity and formation of the rocks would have to be almost instantaneous. That's what got him in trouble. He was arguing for a young Earth, right? He was arguing for a young Earth. Well, I don't like all of the creationist examples, and I'm going to tell you right off the bat, you need to be careful what you read, because some of them are erroneous. So you just can't assume that because somebody says they're a creationist, that what they're telling you is actually true. For instance, you know, we find people putting up examples like living snails that have had their shells dated by carbon-14 up to 2,300 years. Well, that shouldn't be, obviously. Okay? But these examples always are about a tenth, you know, they're almost in the range of experimental error. And they're not very impressive to me. I don't know how old the Earth is. I'm going to tell you on the front end of this. I do not know how old the Earth is, young or old. We have old Earth creationists and young Earth creationists, even within the church. We need to be careful not to make it a test of fellowship while people are studying on this difficult issue. Okay? But anyway, here's one that I found that was just flat wrong. And it really bothered me and it woke me up. Pillow lava is the kind of lava that forms when a volcano, say in Hawaii, lets the lava flow off into the icy waters of the Pacific Ocean. It will begin to form a crust on it while it's still molten lava inside. Probably you have seen pictures on the Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel of people swimming down and hitting these things with iron pipes, and it opens up and there's lava inside what looks like a rock. Well, this was a quote that I found. The evidence that radio clocks have actually been deranged is cleared from the many dating areas of objects of known age. We previously mentioned the 6,000-year spread of dates for Jarmo, which was known to be inhabited for only 500 years, as well as other carbon-14 errors. Errors with the potassium and uranium methods are equally striking. For example, lava from Hawaiian and other volcanoes around the world that is known to have flowed within the last 200 years. In other words, we know that flow of rock went in just from basic historical references within the last 200 years has been dated by the potassium, argon, and uranium lead methods at thousands of millions, which is billions, of years. Surely this demonstrates that the assumptions used in dating techniques are not only truly assumptions, but often truly wrong. I read that in a creationist article. Well, I went back and checked the reference. I went back to the scientific article, and it turns out that what happened was exactly what the research design was designed to show. That when this hot lava fell into the ocean, it would form this crust, and the dates by potassium argon and uranium lead would be off. That was what they were trying to show. It wasn't an accident. They had planned for it, they had predicted it, and they had demonstrated it. This makes it sound like it was a mistake. So I've been a lot more careful in reading some of that creationist literature after I found that out. But I learned something out of this, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody else ever talk about this, and this is how I'm going to close. I thought that the rate of decay could not change. And apparently, the rate of decay did not change in this, and yet the date was wrong. Now think about that for a second. The underlying assumption with these dating methods is that the rate of decay never changes. And so you can be assured that the date will always be accurate. But they proved themselves that if you form the rock by letting lava go straight into the icy waters of the Pacific, that the dates will be wrong, and yet the rate of decay never changed. You know what that tells me? There's more to the clock than the ticking. That's what that tells me. There is more to this radiologic clock than just the ticking. And for people to be dogmatic about this, they need to be very careful. It's very possible that we are not looking at a process that tells us the actual time that has elapsed since that rock was formed, but it's actually telling us more about the process by which that rock was formed. And somebody says, well, that's ridiculous, David. How could all of these things be off? Well, let's just take seriously the biblical view. At some point in time, God created, right? The creation week started. He solidified the earth. He made dry land appear. We don't know how long the earth was here before that. But if he formed the crustal rocks instantaneously, that would explain why we have polonium-214 fingerprints in it, why it didn't all disappear, wouldn't it? If the crustal rocks were formed instantaneously when God created. And it would also explain why maybe these dates are off by magnitudes, you know, magnitudes of years, because of the process by which the rocks were formed just in the creation. But they won't let me talk about that, will they? You can't offer that because it has religious overtones. And so that's the dilemma that we're in. I get to come down here and I get to do this stuff for you, but I have not ever presented this material in my university classrooms. Does that surprise you? Not ever have they heard any of this material in my university classrooms because it is against the law for me to do it. Now, if this has been helpful for you, my guess is it would be helpful for my students, don't you think? A different interpretation, a different way of looking at it that takes seriously that the God of this world brought everything into existence. Well, I'm 10 minutes over. Thank you for your time. We're done.